The Center for Minorities in the Mathematical Sciences presents Mathematically Uncensored,
where our talk is real and complex, but never discreet.
This is Pamela Harris.
This is Eris Winger, and you're listening to Mathematically Uncensored, where our talk is real and complex.
But never discreet.
Happy New Year!
You too!
How are things going? Okay, I'm listening. Let's do it. Yes. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show.
2023 has started, and we're almost through January.
Yes.
And I feel like my life has been I've been on a roller coaster this month.
Okay.
Complete and utter roller coaster.
Now, a roller coaster means ups and downs.
Yes.
Let's get it. Go.
Yeah. So, okay. You know, and we're going to get into the JMM, like, a lot, just kind of like recapping our experiences being at JMM. But, you know, and I'll just kind of preface sort of, I want to start with the low because I want to end somewhat on a high. So JMM was, you know, pretty good to me, and we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I returned, and I guess I should say, like, complete trigger warning for people who love pets.
Okay. I'm sitting here. Okay. I'm bracing now.
You know, I never leave conferences early.
Yeah.
And I left JMM early because I planned it that way. Like, I was just like, I'm done on Friday. Like, I'm going to head home. And initially, I had a plan that I was going to actually go to Japan, and I was going to go to South Korea, and I was going to visit collaborators and make new collaborators, you know, meet new collaborators this January. And for some reason, I was just like, it feels too pressured. Like, the timing is just not right. Like, I'm going to go during the summer.
Okay.
And so I had planned that I was going to be on a flight originally. This is why I was leaving early. I was going to be on a flight to Tokyo on Friday.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, from JMM. Yep. And then I thought, no, I'm just going home. So I went home and I got in, you know, my flight was delayed on Friday, and I'll get into how I had such a great day, all of these things. And I get home on Friday night, and, you know, we have three dogs and my lovely girl Ginger, you know, she's 13 going on 13 years old, black lab, you know, big dog. And she's not feeling well. Like, she's clearly not feeling well, And we're like, well, it's late. Like, let's go to sleep. You know, she probably just needs to rest. Yeah. And we woke up the next morning, and, like, Jamal just rushes to the room, and he's like, there's something really wrong with Ginger. And so I run out, you know, and she has her bed in front of this, like, little fireplace, and she was having a stroke.
Oh, my God. At the moment.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've gone through exactly seeing a dog have a stroke before.
Yeah.
And so I recognized that that's what was happening. So I, let me tell you that I have never been more glad in my life to be as fit as I am. Because I basically just picked up this, like, 75-pound dog.
Yeah.
And was like, we're going to the vet. And so I just said to Akira, like, let's go.
Yes.
So we all ran into the car. I'm also very thankful to be in Milwaukee, because there was an animal hospital within, you know, 7 minutes away from
our
house.
How long was this drive? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, 7 minutes, we're at the animal hospital, and she, you know, they get her to be stable. And, you know, for about 6 months, I've known that the dog has been in decline.
Okay.
You know, like,
yeah,
I could tell, you know, that she's lost a lot of muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she couldn't go up and down the stairs anymore. So she was always, this is why she was by the fireplace. It's nice and cozy. And
yeah.
But let me just say that I, you know, I just was not ready.
Yes.
I was not ready to have to make this decision. You know, she had a big mass on her liver, and the doctor just said, you know, she is very likely in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And at any moment, like, this mass on her liver is going to rupture, and, you know, she could bleed out, you know, internally. And that's not going to be a pleasant death. And so we made the decision that, you know, it was time to say bye. Yeah. And just held her, and you know, we told her we loved her, and she said bye to us.
Yes.
So it's been very rough, because
tell me a story about this animal.
Yeah, she, you know, she came into our family during my last year of my PhD.
Oh, my God. Yes.
You know, she's a rescue dog from the Milwaukee Humane Society. And she was the rut of the litter.
Mm.
So, you know, when I saw her, I was like, you and me, girl, like, we're going to go the distance. God. And she lived by my feet.
Yes.
No matter where I was, like, she was right there. And, you know, she kind of became Akira's dog. Like, Akira has seen, you know, Akira doesn't remember ever living without her.
Right.
And so that, you know, it's been rough on all of us just trying to fill this void.
Yes.
Like, the There's house, you know, missing. even though we have, you know, Scotty and Bubba, and they're also going through their own struggle. Because let me tell you that Ginger was absolutely the alpha dog of this house. And so, you know, the dogs are, you know, Scotty and Bubba are just like trying to figure out who's boss now.
Yes.
So that has led to some not very nice, you know, meals between them trying to get at each other. And so, yeah, so it's just been like one of these moments in my life where I'm reflecting about the way I spend my time.
Oh,
you know, like, you know, sometimes it takes something like this to happen for you to be like, wait, how would I rather be spending my time? Like, do I really want to sit on this new committee that I got invited to by this organization? Yes. Or would I rather be home petting my dog?
Mm.
And that has become a measure of me saying no to some things right now.
Yes.
Like, you know, and I hate that that's what had to happen, but I'm like, there's things going on in my personal life and my family needs me. My daughter needs me. And, you know, this has been really hard for her.
Yes.
And so, you know, the roller coaster, that's been, you know, and it kind of, it's grief for an animal. I think it's really interesting because there's like part of me that is like, it shouldn't hurt this much.
Oh.
Like it is a pet, you know? And like, maybe there's something wrong with me. Like, why is this so, why does it feel so tragic? And like, I literally feel like I lost a part of me. And then I just think about how much time I spend with her.
Yes.
You know, I spend so much more time with her than with almost anybody else in my life.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, so it's just been, it hits you. Like, there's times where I'm totally fine. And then, you know, I just think about, you know, the big spot on her tongue.
Yes.
You know, that like, she just had this mole on her tongue. Or I think about like Akira painting her toenails bright pink, and you know, and so there's just these like, it's hard.
Yeah.
And
so
so the roller coaster.
Yes. When you told me, you know, that, you know, Ginger is at the beginning of your, or at the end of your graduate experience, that says everything.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, she's been there through all the moves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But how have you been? How's it going?
No, I thought we were going to go to the top of the roller coaster. Or I thought we were going to...
We'll get to the top of the roller coaster.
Oh, really? Okay,
let's
good,
see
good,
how
good.
You're doing.
No,
I've
been good. No, I just... It's... At this moment, I'm thinking about Tyre Nichols, of course.
Mm.
And the video being released last night of...
Yeah.
Yes, of his being jumped by a gang of people.
Yeah.
And so with the title of police officer. So, it's been difficult in the sense that, again, I've only had to deal with this as a Black man. And now I'm dealing with it as a husband and a father, too.
Yeah.
So that, oh, my God. So that when I hear about this happening and then I think about me being in his situation. And then I also think about his parents because I'm a parent. And so, and I think about his mother and how she felt. And I think about, you know, his father, you know, and, you know, me being a father and all of it. Right. So now it's like hitting in different dimensions. And so, of course my daughter was talking to my wife about, could this happen to daddy?
Mm-hmm.
And just like, can she, you know, is she going to watch it? Can she watch it herself?
Right.
And there was this whole, and so we didn't let her watch it. My wife couldn't watch it. I felt like I had to watch it. I had to watch it.
Mm.
And I had to watch it because in what I'm trying to do, I have to see America.
Mm.
I have to see it. And so like, you know, it was difficult. It was hard to watch, but like, I can't, for me, and I want to honor the fact that people can't watch it. I get that, right? Like, makes complete sense. You can't, but I have to see this part of America, all of it, because I want to properly criticize it and call it into question. And not to say that if you don't watch it, you can't, but yes, I just felt like I just had to, right? And so it was difficult. And yeah, it's terrible. Another trigger warning, right?
Yeah.
It's terrible, horrible. It's all of that. And again, it makes me think about justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my only plea, and this is the last thing I'll say about it, my only plea is that we as a society, I think, really need to reimagine what justice looks like. I've said this before, unfortunately, on the show, because we've had to talk about what justice looks like. And it cannot, Tyree is dead. These, you know, people, their lives are also going to go down the drain. And there's no justice anywhere in any of that.
Yeah.
And so, again, I will say, for me, that if we pass the Tyree Nichols bill that makes sure that this type of stuff is reduced by 95%, then I think we're moving towards justice.
Yeah.
Right? If we do things. And so that means that justice for Tyree and everybody else cannot be found in the courtroom. It is found in how we as a society together move forward from this.
Yeah.
And so we're all responsible for the justice that can come out of this in demanding more of the people who are our leaders. That's what I'm saying. So, yeah, I mean, so, I hope. And so this notion of what do we do now has come up for me in the last couple of days, in which I gave a talk at a math leadership group institute, and you know, we did a bunch of talking, had a great discussion, and at the end I put up a Padlet, if you can believe it. I put up a Padlet and I said, give me your questions. And at the end it said, what do we do now?
Yeah.
Right. And it's just what do we do now? What do we do now? And like I mean, we have to get active. I think we just have to get active in whatever way we can. But again, as we always say, that we have our voices. There's just too many quiet people.
Yeah.
I think who are just, you know, waiting for stuff like this to happen. And then they're vocal and then they get quiet again. And again, we got to fight this every day. So I'll say that. So I've been thinking about that in the last 24 hours for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's disheartening to just see this continue to happen so often, and how many people just get so desensitized to so much violence and so much, you know, the straight up murders of Black men.
Yes.
And women. Right.
Yes.
And so it's just, it's just heartbreaking.
It is
just heartbreaking.
Yes.
To live in a society where this becomes
normal,
part of our everyday experience.
Yeah.
And then we're supposed to walk into our classrooms.
No, that's
we're supposed to walk into our research meetings, into our committee meetings.
Yes.
And have this discussion about whether we're going to turn this classroom into a lounge.
Right. Oh my God.
Right. Right. Or have this discussion as to whether we renumber courses or.
Right.
Yeah. So it's so difficult to be able to just compartmentalize all of these aspects of who we are and the things that we experience and the way that we experience the world.
Yes.
And separate that from our professional life in the way that so many other people can do.
Yes.
So, thank you for sharing.
Yeah. And this is not, of course, this is our first show and this is the recency effect, but this is not to negate the massive, you know, shootings that have been going on at the start of the
year.
Yeah, There's something about the start of the year, because like 2 years ago, I was like, the start of the year is crazy, because then we had the insurrection 2 years ago.
Yes.
Like the start of the year is wild sometimes. So
Yes.
And then like, and then the JMM piece, like we should just have our own separate JMM show. Right.
Yes.
Debrief.
That's basically what we need. A JMM episode as well.
That's right. Yeah.
Ooh, well, you know, we hope that folks are doing well with the start of the new year and, you know, have been having a gentle holiday season. But, you know, we know that we appreciate or know that we appreciate you when you share the show. So feel free to tweet and post about the episodes. You can always hit us up on Twitter at Math Uncensored, at Minority Math. I'm at DPE Harris and Eris is at Eris Winger. So yeah, share with us how the new year has started for you. And hopefully there's some positives there,
yeah,
along with the challenging things that we're all going through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So JMM.
Yes. No, I mean, JMM. Yeah, it was weird. I mean, so this is my first JMM officially is the executive director of NAMM. And so it's like, this is the first one where I'm going not as me only, right? Like I'm going to just complete, like every time I ran into somebody, they was like, so you give them a talk? I was like, no, it's just all NAMM, right?
So,
which was great. I mean, again, it's just such an honor to serve in this way. Yeah, it was weird that I was just on a mission to go and do the things that we had set up and the events that we had. So we had the banquet, we had we ran some talks. And there's also this, and this is good because this is uncensored, so I got to say it. So there's also just, you know, showing up to places and showing my face and just being visible as a way of showing respect to people who, you know, we want to continue to honor and respect. So there were some places, you know, I showed up to that I was there because I'm the executive director and Eris would have had his ass still in the bed. You know what I mean? For sure. Again, it's uncensored. Yeah, no. I was just saying.
Yeah.
So, like, no.
The executive director has to show up. Unfortunately, that's me this morning.
That's me. No, that's right. So there's some of those things too. So, and then we had the business meeting and it was just a whole different type of JMM because of my position and and we were there at the opening, the cutting of the ribbon. Like it was crazy. It was crazy. So it was just getting used to my new identity in a lot of ways.
And if you have to contrast one aspect of that, so it's like I'm hearing that you have a responsibility to show up based on your position, but as an individual, you might have not shown up to these things.
Yeah.
But like, how do you balance that? How do you make that call, right? Because there's got to be a point in which like you're like, no. Even though I am executive director, I cannot support this. How do you make that?
No, because
like that
because,
choice.
No, because the organization is more important than my personal feelings. See, that's just the way that I roll. If you give me a job, then I'm going to try and execute the job. So, and this is tied to some of the events, some of the feelings I had during the event. But I am a representative for an organization that is 50-something years old, you know, 1959. And it's an organization that has been held up by Black people. And Black people have just spent decades literally upholding this organization, and I'm doing it for them. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just something bigger than me. And so when at the banquet, when we honored Scott Williams and he goes up there for his speech for the Lifetime Achievement Award from NAMM, and he talks about 1959 and he talks about, you know, the rejection from the AMS of these 17, you know, Black math professionals. And he talks about how he was a graduate student. Right. And that some of the founders and that he found the courage and they found the courage to do something different, you know, then there's just no, you know, there's just no doubt. So if this was some other organization, then it might be hard, but this is not.
Right.
This is easy. And of course, the role that NAMM has played in my own life as a mathematician and all of it. Right. So
yeah,
it was easy. It's easy to be like, okay, I got to get up and do this. Right.
So,
but I've said on the show before, this balance between, again, like, you know, when I hear something, so like I haven't had to not be who I was in terms of being able to communicate with other people. Because again, I will be removed as executive director before I'm not who I am, because that ultimately takes the precedence. But I'm just talking about being lazy, not getting my ass out the bed. Right. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. I mean, like, there's just some stuff, or not wanting to go home and sit down and be like, okay, so yeah, because I mean, and part of it has been some people are like, oh, Eris, can we talk? And I think we can collaborate. Mm-hmm. And like, we're only collaborating because I'm with Nam, not because I'm Eris Winger. Yeah. And it's just like, okay, let me have this hour and a half conversation. I loved all my conversations at JMM, by the way, to all the people who are listening. Mm-hmm. Like, are you talking about me? Like, no, I'm not. So people want to have hour and a half conversations about NAMM. And I'm like, okay, that's great. Let's do it, right? For NAMM. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's making me think about, you know, times where I am part of an organization that is not, you know, doesn't still yet feel like it's completely for me, where there's like some aspect of my identity, which is like on a spotlight for that organization, but maybe not fully authentically all of me.
Yes.
And how hard that has been, because there is that aspect of a missing history, a missing set of people whose legacy sort of precedes me, that then I want to I feel just so utterly and completely connected to that organization that then I want to give it my all.
Yes.
And so I'm really happy that you talked about this, because it gives the value of the history and the impact that NAMM has had throughout your entire career and for many other Black mathematicians as well. So I think that's the distinction, right? I think that sometimes, you know, and I might be completely wrong, but I feel like if you are part of the majority and you are part of an organization, it's much easier to just be like, that doesn't align well with my personal view on things.
Yes.
So I'm not showing up at 7:30, even though I am the blah title.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so there's like, is there pressure? Is there pressure? Mm. Is the pressure higher on people of color who hold leadership positions, again, to be like representative not only of the organization, but like of the whole community
of mathematicians of color? Yes, sometimes, of course.
Yeah,
because, I mean, because, again, there's some element of a fight in it, right? The way you're fighting for visibility this is what, to be outside the margins, to be in the middle, in the conversation, all of it, of course. Yeah, I think it's unavoidable.
And so it makes me think a little bit about, you know, some of these events that, you know, the center, you know, who holds our podcast, helped organize and sponsor the storytelling event. So it's making me think about that, right? That we had this storytelling event on Thursday of JMM, and just completely optional, you know, people knew about it by sort of word of mouth.
Yeah.
They got put on the schedule, and it just felt, for me, being at JMM, and in particular being at this event, you know, there was something really full circle happening.
Mm.
And it didn't actually hit me until like about an hour before the event.
Oh.
And so maybe let me just back up and tell you what happened to me the previous time I had been at Boston at JMM. Mm. And I don't think I've told you this story. I've actually written about it. It's a chapter in a book, A Stories from the Front of the Room. So I was at JMM 2000. I think this was 2012, actually. Yeah,
okay.
2012.
Okay.
We're in Boston. I'm on the job market. It's my first time ever at JMM. And I'm at the cattle call. I don't know if people know what I mean by that, but the cattle call is the interview center.
Okay. Okay.
Where like everybody's just sitting there like little cattle, and then they call your name, and then you're like, okay, I'm next to the slaughterhouse, you know?
Yes. So
I go there, and let me preface this by saying that, you know, when I submitted my materials on math jobs, at that point I had been told that, you know, like, you know, some jobs discriminate if they think you are an immigrant and you're not a U.S. citizen.
Whom? But you were told by whom?
Somebody in my department.
Okay, this wasn't on the website or anything.
It was like, you know, some people, there's bias in hiring. Mm. And so if you say I'm originally from Mexico, maybe some people are going to be like, oh, well, do you have a green card? Are you looking to get sponsored? Do you need a visa? Like, you might not get a job. And so if you're mentioning this, you might want to just say that you're a U.S. citizen. You know, because then people are like, oh, okay, cool. We don't need this. So anyway, so on my CV, again, first time ever on the job market, what did I know? Okay. Yes. I might as well have just put my social security number, my mother's maiden name, and my credit card information. Okay. because I put everything on this freaking thing.
Okay.
And so it said, you know, born in Mexico, U.S. citizen, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So I'm going to one of these interviews, 20-minute interviews, and there's two people that are going to interview me. So the first person come and gets me from the little kettle call, brings me to the table, making, you know, sort of decent chat, just like, hello, how's it going, blah, blah, blah. The other dude, as I'm approaching this little table, he is, like, clearly looking at my CV.
Okay.
Like, he just has it in front of him. He's just, like, reading it, kind of looking at it. I sit down, and he looks up, and complete shock in his face to, like, I don't know what he imagined I would look like. But then he is really confused, and he leans back in his chair, points at my name tag that's sitting right on my chest.
Yes.
And then points at my face. Back at the name tag, back at my face. And so I don't understand.
Don't understand.
And then
what?
I said, exactly. I was like, what? And then he says, so your dad must be white and your mom must be Mexican.
Absolutely not.
I You've promise written you, this about is what this man said. Yes, I have. I have. Chapter in a book. Okay.
Oh, we got to put that in the show notes. Okay.
Yeah. And so I'm like, no, both of my parents are Mexican. And then he says, but I don't understand. Why is your last name Harris?
What
so then I said, oh,
on?
So I'm like, okay. I was like, well, I am married to a black man and the last name Harris is a common last name. And I took his last name. And then he said, oh, okay. And he's still like, you can see the wheels turning in this man's head,
oh,
you know?
God.
And then he said to me, well, why are you interested in this little liberal arts school in Connecticut? And I said, oh, well, on your website, you mentioned that you do all of this outreach opportunities with students at nearby schools that are like socioeconomically disadvantaged. And I thought that was really great. Like, I'm really interested in introducing mathematics to students at all ages. And like, I remember this, you know? And then he said, oh yeah, well, those people don't value math. It's a cultural issue. He went on and on and on.
And
yes, I promise you, Eris. I promise you.
And the person sitting next to him.
Complete mouth open, doesn't know what to say.
Okay.
Now, let me be clear. That person that had brought me was way younger.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
This was their senior faculty member.
Yeah.
So you know they were not about to say a damn thing.
Right.
They were not going to say anything. But he just did not say a thing during the entire time. So at some point, very quickly after all these comments, I'm like, I don't know what to say. And then he says, well, thank you so much for meeting with us. And he dismisses me.
Unbelievable.
Dismisses me. And I get up. And now it is customary that somebody walks you out.
Yes, that's right.
Of them walked me out. I walked out of there. I directly walked out of there and I went to the restroom.
Yes.
And I locked myself in a stall and I cried and I called my husband. And then I posted on Facebook all of the shit that happened.
Yes.
And so this is how I come back full circle to this whole thing.
Yeah.
I had forgotten all about this heiress.
No. Okay.
Okay. I'm headed to go meet with one of the storytellers.
Yes.
Prior to this event.
Yes.
And I need to use the restroom.
Oh my God.
I walk into the very same bathroom. And immediately, like the wave of emotions of recognizing the bathroom.
Oh my God.
Hit me like a ton of bricks. And so I go into this bathroom and I'm like, this happened 11 years ago. And I'm like, was it 11 years ago today?
Right.
And it was not. It was off by a day. It was like the very next day that it had been exactly 11 years ago. And so I say all of that to say that was my experience as a woman of color going to JMM for the very first time. And I can tell you many, many more things that happened during that same conference because A, I did not keep quiet. I complained. I reported. I did everything and nothing changed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
I reported it to my dean when I got home. Like I did all the things that we are told that we should do.
Yeah.
And nothing changed. Okay.
Yes.
Anyways. So I go to the storytelling event and And it was just like so surreal to have remembered this experience I had 11 years ago and to now walk the convention center and have the experience of, you know, of some listeners coming up to me and giving me a card, like, thank you so much for all the work that you do.
Amazing.
You know, or and going to go see, you know, my PhD student giving their math talks, plural.
Yes.
And being there and like seeing the humanity and the passion and the love and the care that this community that I now feel a part of, which is this like subset of, you know, people of color, allies, supporters, you know, people who really do value people over math, and to for it to culminate with this, the first ever storytelling event at JMM, just was like such a full circle moment.
It's unbelievable
in my life.
That story. Yes. And so, how was the event?
Amazing.
Give me two reasons why. Give me two reasons why.
The emotion surrounding just like the room.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so I'm somebody who walks into a space and immediately feels.
Yes.
And like, I could just walk in and I'm like, there's tension. Who's mad at who?
Right.
You know, like, what happened that I missed, you know?
Yes.
But I walk in there and it was like, it felt colorful. It felt vibrant. It felt like there was this energy in the room with people so excited to just reconnect with each other and like hear about each other and like being enthralled in these stories about who our mathematician friends, who, I mean, some of whom I've known for over a decade.
And you heard
and
things
I hear
you
this
didn't
story,
know. Yes.
And I was like, what?
Yes.
This is amazing.
Yes.
And so it was just so powerful. And I don't know that I've ever
been. Can you
been...
imagine if every department just did that? Just
for the sake of doing it. That would be amazing.
Because it's be like so literally amazing. you're seeing people add dimensions to themselves right in front of you. Like you think of someone else. Anyway, I interrupted you.
No. And no, you're absolutely right. And just like, you know, hearing the story of people's names, you know, hearing the story of, you know, like what they've gone through to be able to get to where they are.
Yes.
The story of their bicycle. You know what I mean? Just like things that are meaningful to someone in a way that you sometimes don't understand.
Yes.
And so it's just, it was just so fulfilling in a way that I anticipated, but I didn't, like I came with a cup. And it filled and it filled and it filled and it just overfilled, you know?
And so
I just want to say thank you so much to Selvie and Patty for thinking of this idea, for creating this space and for working for three JMMs to make this happen until we finally were able to do this in person.
Yes.
I don't think that had we done it virtually, it would have gone as well.
God,
that same like sense
of
connectedness
and
then just like having the ability to just have a glass of wine. Like it was just so lovely. It was so, so lovely. It really was absolutely the pinnacle of JMM for me. And there was many pinnacles, you know, but that one sort of holds a very special place in my heart.
Well,
and so
I think
I'm just so thankful.
Yeah. I think it's important to, there are two things here. And one is I have a question for you. But the first I have to say is that this event is tied to some organizations coming together and saying we need to be able to tell our stories.
Yes.
So I don't want it. Yes, I want because and the reason I bring this up is because it's tied to what we've been saying for the last three seasons about us being able to take control of our own narratives. And saying that we don't need anybody else's permission to do it. We don't need, so shout out to the center for sure for organizing this and getting organizations together to say, let's do this and let's tell our own stories because they're worthy enough to tell.
Yes.
So my question for you is, did you feel welcome at the JMM?
Okay, so
I know that's a hard question.
Yes. No. It's a very, very hard question. And,
yes.
And I think it's like very nuanced, right?
Yes, that's why I asked it.
I think the answer is yes. Yeah. And one, because I curated the hell out of my JMM experience, curated it. Yeah. I knew what I was going to do, who I was going to see, and exactly when that would happen. And if that was not part of the schedule, you were not going to find me.
And you had the privilege to do so.
I had a tremendous amount of privilege to do so. I wasn't on the job market.
Right.
Right. Which is like a very big, I mean, I just told you this story about where the trauma happens.
Yes.
Like the trauma happens at these spaces that we don't have our people in.
Yes.
That you're one of one basically in the room. And so I curated my experience at JMM by going, you know, where I knew people, where I knew my students were giving a talk, right? Where I knew my friends were going to be at, where I knew my collaborators were.
Yes.
And the second that their talk was over, I peaced out.
Yes. You left. Right.
You know, I was just like, bye. And to be honest, like, I'm sure that I missed a ton of opportunities to connect with brand new people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I am certain I missed opportunities to connect with potential new students, new collaborators, new opportunities, right? Because I did not socialize. Like, I didn't go there to network. I think I showed up with a completely different perspective. I was not there to advance my career. Like, I was there to go support my students.
Yes.
I was there to be in the back of the room. And when they're like, Zoe, you know, and her team presenting, and I'm like, what? You know, being that annoying, you know, person in the back with confetti.
Yes.
And so I think having shown up with a mission that was outside of me helped me curate my experience to be by far the most positive JMM experience I've ever had.
That is fantastic. Well, that's great. That's great. Well, there are two things here that jump out to me. One, I'm happy for you for sure, right? And I'm thinking about my own privilege in this space because I have no clue whether they still even do the job thing at all.
Oh, they do.
They do? I have no idea.
It's by the exhibit hall.
I had no clue. So yeah, I remember doing this one time and I had one interview. I don't even remember who the school was. It felt awkward. I guess I want to talk about this for just a couple of minutes because I wonder how that's going. I'm so detached from that. Uh-oh. See, we were on the YouTube channel. Yeah. Dr. Harris shrugged her shoulders like, I don't know either. Yeah, I'm wondering about if things have gotten better in that space.
Well, I can say one thing.
Please.
I can say one thing. Okay. During the storytelling event, there was a conversation, you know, that we were having. And I just asked, like, out loud. I said, can I just ask, did anybody here have an interview in a hotel room?
Mm.
And there were still at least one person who raised their hand. And so let me just speak to that. So, you know, the last time I had interviews at JMM, I mean, I actually had interviews at JMM while I was on tenure track. But at that point, I knew better that you as an employer should not be inviting candidates to a hotel room to do an interview. I don't care if your hotel room has a little lounge and you know, sofa, or there's going to be five other people there. Like, it is just extremely uncomfortable. And in 2011, when I was there, I had interviews at hotel rooms.
Okay.
And there were departments who were interviewing me and half of them are sitting on a bed. And at the time I was like, this feels really icky and weird. And I remember calling my husband before I walked into the hotel and I said, here's the hotel address. I'm supposed to go to room 301, whatever room, you know? And I was like, it says it's a 20 minute interview. If I don't call you in 30 minutes, like, call the lobby.
Yeah.
And he was like, are you sure you want to do this? And I was like, it's a job. I need a job. Right. And so I asked, and this is something that's still happening. And JMM, you know, and I said out loud, you know, in Spanish we say sin pelos en la lengua, like, you just say it. You know, AMS needs to do better. Like, I don't know. And I've written about this. Okay. I've written about this with Carrie Diaz Eaton and Susan Crook. We wrote about this, I think it was 2019, that JMM needs to ban institutions from being able to attend JMM if they are found out and reported to be hosting interviews in hotel rooms.
Well, no, and that's why. So I right now I'm doing some hard work on the inside, not to go.
No, don't do the hard work.
Because I've done this before many times. I've gotten angry, and then people are just like, "Well, we have a policy. It's written here." So I'm going to simply ask whether there is something written somewhere on the website, and if there isn't, then we have serious problems. Yes.
I'm sure there is. Who's listening?
No, that's right. Okay, so this is
good. Who knows that such a policy exists? Right? So like, we get daily messages when you're at JMM.
Yes.
Where's the daily message that says, just a reminder.
Yes.
If you are registered to have interviews during JMM and you're invited to a hotel room, please report the institution.
Absolutely. No. And that's part of a list of inappropriate behavior we're talking about. So let's step back again. We're talking about power. Right. Mm-hmm. We're talking about how do we not let people abuse their power? So, what is the policy for what are these people called? Interviewing institutions?
For
institutions. What is the policy of behavior? Yeah. For employers at the JMM, because that appalls me. It angers me to no end. And I think we need a mechanism in which these people can be reported.
Yeah. And there is, I know that they've set up, that there's like people who volunteer at JMM to take reports, to be supportive, So somebody did come forth and they said, if you have something to report, like I volunteer for AMS doing this kind of work.
Somebody
did come forth and say that. But the problem is that like you have to know who that person is.
Yes.
Sometimes I don't know. People have. They know each other. They don't know each other. Yeah. Do I trust you? Do I not trust you? And so just having a way to collect this anonymous data.
Yeah.
But there's also got to be like some sort of punishment. I'm sorry. Like at what point do you not know?
Yes, we're that getting there to the punishment.
In a hotel room. You know what I mean?
Like, yes.
Yeah. Like somehow your institution just can't come. Your institution cannot come.
No.
All of your faculty members cannot come. One of y'all should have been like, this is inappropriate. And we are not going to put young people through this.
Correct. Yeah. Or anybody. Yeah. So I will get to the punishment part. You have to have that, of course. So I know that because when I downloaded the app, there had to be some button to say, click this button if something inappropriate is happening. There's no doubt about that. Right. I'm pretty sure about that. But just like we've been saying, and this is true of Dave Mandershot, like I said this a couple of weeks ago, that like, there's something about making sure that you have policies written, but it's also something about your voice. You gotta be explicit. Like I don't even know what the opening ceremony looks like in terms of when that exhibit, when the employee place opens, but what does it look like for whoever opens it to say, now remember our code of conduct.
Exactly.
What is the code of conduct for employers? Right?
Yes.
I guess that's what we're saying. And to your point again, what are the punishments if that code of conduct is violated? Right? And I think we just need that to be explicit. So, I think we can make that a clear call to action to the AMS and the folks at JMM to say, let's get... And again, I will say there may be one for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And I just haven't heard about it. And maybe that's all on me. But I'll be looking, and we'll report in 2 weeks about this.
And like I said, I know they have this, I think it's like Math Safe or something like this. There's a group of people who have like a little badge.
Absolutely, and I got an email, and I wanted to do it myself, but I was just too busy, obviously, to volunteer. But so I think they're doing great work there. We need to check just to make sure that there's something there. But the fact that someone... In that public space, even though it was intimate public space, still could offer that they were in someone's hotel room. It's just unbelievable.
It's just not okay.
And one's bed should ever be seen.
Oh,
what in the world?
I can't.
This is like, what?
It's happening.
I don't want to see people's beds in Zoom. In Zoom calls, I've seen people's beds in the back room.
I mean, you and I know each other well, but you ain't about to see my bedroom. Come on!
It's just like, what? come. And what I don't even know how that conversation goes. Like, can you just meet me in my hotel room and we can talk about, like, how do you even say that?
How do you
even say something like that? It's just unbelievable.
And that you have to put it in writing. You're like, yes, we'll meet at this hotel in this room.
What do you mean? What do you mean you have to put it in writing?
They put it in writing, Eris, when they invite you to this interview. They're like, we'll meet at this place.
Wait, that can't. Yes. No. Not that was all informal.
No. These are like official job interviews.
No, there's no official. No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I thought you had to meet in the exhibit hall, in the hall.
No. Okay. Oh my God, Eris. So what's happening is AMS charges an institution X many dollars for a table at the job center.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
So these institutions are tiny. They don't want to spend X dollars. And they already have a hotel room. So they're going to invite their candidate to meet in this hotel room instead.
No, but the question is how? That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's going to... No one's writing this on paper.
Yes, I had email invitations in 2011.
To meet in hotel room X342.
Yes, from the chair of the search committee at the place I had interviewed. Yes.
And so what you're thinking, that's still happening today.
Oh, what I know, I don't know if they put it in writing, but what I do know is that someone said that they had an interview in a hotel room.
Okay.
So this isn't like you meet at the exhibit thing and they're like, let's go to our hotel. Like, that's not it. They set you up to have the interview in a hotel to begin with.
Yes. Okay.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yes. Okay. Got it. Okay. Yeah, and no, if you at minoritymath.org, and so if you think we're crazy, that's fine.
Yeah.
No, if you think somehow we are that we are just completely wrong about this, I don't know. For me, it just doesn't feel right to me. I'm sorry.
It's not right.
I just don't get it. I don't get it. So if you think it's fine, you've done it, it's been okay, MU at minoritymath.org, we appreciate the perspective. Maybe I'm missing something. I just can't see it. I just can't.
No, I know. I know. So, I can't either, but I'm excited to hear what other people think about this.
Yeah, no, so, and then I want to be honest. So I did, as executive director, I did have this nice suite, right, in the Boston room. And I had one of these attached rooms. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I can see a room. I can see a space because they were separate rooms. I had two doors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see that as something in which somebody might say, oh, this is fine. Because it was like a separate room and I still can't do it.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So first off, I'm saying I had actual interviews in hotel rooms where a bed was present. That is a fact.
Yes.
And I can I could even tell you what university it was. Okay, because I remember. I was like, this is creepy.
Yes.
Okay, but it was like seven faculty members in the room, and there was just not enough space and enough chairs, so three of them were sitting on the bed.
Yeah.
Okay? All right, got it. But what I'm saying is that now I also had interviews in the room that you're describing.
Yes.
Which there's a bedroom, and then there's a living room.
Yes.
But the point is that it still was creepy.
Of course it is.
Anyway.
No, because like going up the elevator, walking through the hallway, like I just.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
Okay.
All of that. Okay. Yes.
MU at minoritymath.org. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. But here's another thing that, you know, I was thinking about in terms of how life-changing the storytelling event felt like.
Mm, yes.
That I started thinking about all these other mathematical spaces, all these other math conferences that we go to, and whether there is room to do that kind of activity or something like it, maybe on a smaller scale. Like, how do we recreate that feeling that we had at the storytelling event? How do we infuse that into all these other events that we go to, all these other conferences or workshops, symposia, like, how do we do that? Or do we even have to?
Yes.
Because we've been talking about JMM and like, this is a math conference and literally we haven't talked about any math.
No, but that's up for debate. Let me be clear about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So whether we have or not, I mean, so I get that. So this makes me think about belonging and what type of what is the responsibility of a conference to have belonging events, right, for the people who are coming to your conference? And so I'm of the mind, working in the area of belonging in mathematics, I'm of the mind that if your attempt is to bring marginalized people, they're marginalized for a reason. So what in the world could we mean by inclusion? Right? Mm. So, I mean,
you just invite people.
Yes, that's right. So, but you invite people and then they're over in the corner. So, yeah, I mean, so when you invite marginalized people, just because you get the invitation doesn't mean they're still not in the margins.
Mm.
Right? And so the question becomes that, and again, this is a big if, because some of y'all say you're interested, but you're really not. If you really want to do DEI work and really be inclusive, then you might want to think about having an event as a part of your conference and that will allow for that to happen, in which people can, you know, have voices and feel like they are welcome and all of that. And what does that look like, right? Like, because now...
Well, they put out coffee. They put out coffee. What do you mean?
Yes. You mean surface level coffee shit. Oh, yeah. Let's have a coffee. Let's have a little meeting before we start.
There's a coffee hour. Yeah.
So, this is right. No, and this is what happens. And so, because I think that part of the thing that happens, and this is tied to when I went to this meeting of the leaders for DEI in the discipline, you know...
The 7:30 morning.
Oh, yes. I got up for that motherfucker. So,
dying.
No, but it's one of these things where, I mean, I was in a situation, I was at a table that just one person talked and that was it.
Mm.
Right. And then nothing, we didn't get a chance to talk about anything else. So I bring this up only because that we have to be more intentional about how we create social spaces at our events. Right. And so the invitation is not enough for us to be welcome. You can't have the morning tea and that be enough, right? It has to be deliberate. It has to be, let's have the morning tea and let's have everybody share, talk about something, right? Like have something in which we can be like, thank you for listening to my story.
Yeah. So are you of the mind that if people are going to be doing this DEI work and help marginalized people feel included into these mathematical conferences, that it really isn't the math? Like, it can't just be the math, is what you're saying.
No, I mean, again, it's a big if. I mean, if you're running a conference and you're just like, I want more of this group, or I want more diversity, or I want this conference to look different, then you have to do something different. Like, what you have been doing is you've been doing, quote, just the math. And now you want to have a more diverse, and you want your conference to look different, and you still just want to do just the math, right? Mm. Now, you know that if you keep putting in the same conditions into a theorem, you're going to get the same fucking implications. Right? So you have to do something different. And so what I'm excited about is that this is a hard problem. We don't really know the answer. So I want you to try all sorts of things. I want you to reach out to people and say, what should I do? I want you to reach out to the groups that you want to come and say, what should we do? Right? Mm-hmm. Now, again, we know that's hard because we don't want to give them all the work to do something that you're supposed to be doing. Right? So, of course, you got to balance and talk to the people who actually want to talk to you. Right? Like, yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, you have to do something different and have events because if you want people who don't feel welcome to feel welcome, then you need to make them feel welcome.
Yeah. So the thing that I'm thinking about, you know, so just to give you the way that I'm thinking about this problem.
Yeah.
You know, I have a visitor currently here, you know, so Joseph Rennie, Dr. Joseph Rennie. He was one of my graduate TAs when we were at MSRI up 2019.
Oh, okay.
So he's visiting. He gave a freaking phenomenal colloquia yesterday about category theory.
Okay.
You know, at UW-Milwaukee. And so he's visiting and we're having a ton of fun. And we were having this conversation about coffee.
Okay.
And how, you know, as mathematicians, like, it is so well rewarded that we just have coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to talk math? Let's go get coffee. You want to talk math? Coffee. It doesn't matter where you are. It's just like, just infused in our culture, pun completely intended.
Yeah.
And the problem is that some folks don't drink coffee.
Right.
And so when we, again, when we think about these ways in which we imagine the community collaborating or socializing in this collaborative environment, we default to coffee. Sometimes we default to alcohol,
right?
We default to let's go to the bar after the talk
to
connect with each other. And it continues to exclude certain people.
Yes.
Right. And so what I'm thinking about is that when I show up to these spaces, the culture is set up in such a way so that white people can show up. And most of the time, the way that the culture is set up is for them.
Yes.
And that the spaces and the coffee hour and the kind of pastry that is provided is something that is predominantly something that I don't eat.
Yes.
Right? Or something that I don't like, or a drink that I'm not accustomed to.
Yes.
And so immediately I feel excluded.
Yes.
And I think about, you know, how many times are we somewhere and then the default is that we're going to go to a restaurant that has no vegan options.
Right.
A restaurant that has no vegetarian options. Right. And then once in a while, there's somebody in the group and they're like, there's really nothing I can eat here. And then we all feel terrible. Worst.
Right.
We all feel terrible. And then we're happy to be like, actually, where should we go? Let's go somewhere else. And I think that's what I'm saying. That the default should be that there might be somebody who's vegan. There might be somebody who doesn't drink coffee. Yeah. There might be somebody who really needs to connect with a few people before they can feel like they can sit next to them to hear this hour plenary on category theory.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Right? And so it's just, but like, I can hear it in my head. Like, I can imagine being in this organizing committee and they're like, so now you want me to like organize an icebreaker? And like, again, how am I going to do that? You know, like, I don't know how to do that.
Yes.
And so, like, I can hear it in my head. Course. I can see these people's faces. So like, what do you say to that?
Yeah, no, that's the great question. And again, that's why the if is big. That's the person who's just not. Yeah. Again, if you want to do it, then you are going to have to do something different. Yeah, you are. That's the way it is. So, I mean, the people who say, yeah, and jaded is not the right word, but yeah, I'm losing patience for the people who are just like, oh, I want to do this work. But wait, you want me to do this extra thing? Yes, 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 I do.
Okay, but like, here's the other thing. Like, I can see somebody saying, well, JMM is this big space, right? Yeah. So like everyone comes. And so there's like a lot of needs of the community, which is why the storytelling event made total sense. You have people who are coming there for, you know, teaching, pedagogy, for research, for policies, right? Like there's just so many different needs at JMM that of course one can fathom that somebody would need this connection, this like humanizing mathematics, right? Like you're telling me that when I go to this like category theory, super niche conference, we need that too?
So here's the deal. This is great. Thank you. Here's what, and you and I have said this so many times, along with Michael as well. Let's talk about what due diligence is, right? You're going to invite 50 people to your small conference. How about sending out a legitimate feedback form about what people are going to need to come to this thing? And you just ask them. And then you base your conference around that, around the needs of the people who are coming, right? So that now when I look at one of the questions and someone says they need tortillas, then I'm going to have some.
I'm just going to bring some. I'll be so happy.
Yeah, right. And that conference completely changes. For someone who might have wanted tortillas. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Like, it's not. And again, so back to the 5%. Yeah, it's a form. It's a form. And then now when you add a few things here and there, people are like, oh, my God, you got this for me.
Yeah.
Or you have, you got this. This is my favorite bagel. What? I don't give a fuck what it is. Like, yeah, but
it's
right
funny
now.
You say that. Because we had an experience like that, you and I, right, in October, where we went somewhere. And in the conversation, preparing for us taking this trip, the person said, you know, let's just go around and discuss, like, what are your favorite snacks? Like, it was a way to just kind of connect. And we were, like, joking about juice and, like, jerky and whatever random other things we said. And then we showed up. And do you remember what was there?
The things we said we liked.
The things we said we liked.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, we were just like, wow, this is so thoughtful.
Yes.
And it was like a very small thing
yes.
that indicated that we mattered.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. And I think what I like about what you said, just to, you know, echo and amplify it, is that we're not talking about, you know, getting rid of one of the plenaries in your conference to have a roundabout of our feelings.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That is not what we're saying. What you're saying is that just have a non-zero amount
yes.
of being able to connect with one each, with one another in some authentic way.
Yes. Yes,
yeah,
yes,
and,
yes.
And like I love the idea of the form, like the survey prior, because you know how many times I go to math conferences and, you know, these week long math conferences, they tend to have like a Wednesday afternoon off.
Yes.
And then the only activity is hiking. Okay. And then I just feel angry.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, there was a bomb ass Mexican place down the street that,
yes.
that now I'm going to go by myself because everyone's going on the stupid hike. There was
yes.
no other options provided.
Yes.
What about people with limited mobility?
Yes.
Like, oh, now we got to go on this hike.
Right. Right. And
again,
there's something about
yeah.
everybody doesn't have to do one event, one activity. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. you can split up. And people do some
yes.
this and everyone just feel great and have had a great time, right? That's
yes.
also fine. Yeah. So
yeah.
so I want to be clear that we have encompassed everything. If the conference is massive, then you have enough events so that people can go to events and feel welcome. If the conference is small, then you can just send out forms and attend to the personal needs of your small little ass conference.
Mm.
So that there are no excuses about,
no excuses.
You know, being able to attend to the people who come to your shit.
Seriously.
So, yeah. So.
Yeah, I think it's this intentionality too that you're pointing
yes.
out, right? Like if you, I love the emphasis on the if. Like if you really care about DEI,
yes.
if you really care about creating inclusive environments where people feel welcome,
yes.
then you gotta do something
yes.
different
yes.
than what you've always done.
That's correct. That is right. Yes, yes, yes.
Ooh. Yeah, yes. otherwise the rest of us are just curating or not going.
That's right. Yeah,
peace
your
out.
Shit's gonna get cut out. Yeah, you're
yeah,
not going to see us.
Seriously.
Absolutely. I do want to say that I went to, so we've been talking about the core work for mm-hmm. years now.
For years.
And so, yeah, so now it's starting to show up out in the public, which is fantastic to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so the incredible Sarah Sori gave her talk. She's one of the co-PIs on the work in interviewing 75 to 100 graduate students of color. And these graduate students are in different phases of their graduate math experience, you know, from first year to almost finishing. And so, yeah, it was great. The centerpiece of it all was that she put up all the quotes, lots of the quotes, the impactful quotes from students who said that they felt literally invisible, right? They felt
yeah.
like someone said that they felt like a ghost, right? In their
Oof.
Graduate. Yes. No, it was very powerful. And I was sitting there and I've read all of these,
yes.
right? If not most of them. Yeah. And then but I was there as an observer to see how people were going to react. And it did exactly what it was supposed to do. I mean, people,
mm-hmm.
you know, were just like, you know, it really resonated. You know, like you said, you know, you get a gauge of the feel of the room. This like took
mm-hmm.
people's breath away, right? And
yeah.
so, but two things come up from that. One, again, is the shock and awe of like, there were still some people who were just like, oh my God, I can't believe that, right?
No.
And I'm just, yeah, I'm struggling that if you're still shock and awe and you can't believe it, then that means you aren't ready to do the work to fight on the right
mm-hmm.
side of history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's please get over our shock and awe, and let's again multiply by 100. That if you're looking at these quotes from these 75, then that means there's 75,000 people. I multiplied by 1,000
right.
instead. So 75,000 people who are struggling in very similar ways, who are very, very quiet
right.
about it. So and so what I said was, you know, what if we just act as if everybody was going through something like this?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just pretend like everybody. And then
mm-hmm.
how will we change accordingly? And then, of course, at the end, people were just like, so what do you want us to do?
Yeah.
What do you want us to do? That's always the question at the end. I think she answered it well. But again, it was only 30 minutes. That's the real question about. But this is why I think we go back to the mentorship. Mentorship is
yeah.
everything. And, you know, that makes me think, of course, of the event we have coming up in March. Mentoring for equity. And mentoring is everything. And so
yeah.
when we think about, when I read these interviews, And I think about people's experiences, you know, and Michael's helped me with this about who is your mentor? Mm-hmm. You just ask, who is your mentor, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also that you can't just have one. That's the thing that I struggle a lot with, right? Yes. That like, and then here's why you in general, right? Why we can't just have one is that there's times where, you know, I think I'm a decent mentor. I have many failings still, but I think I'm decent. And I try to tell students, like when I'm concerned about something that they're doing or like, you know, hey, here's some other options for you. And there's times where I've had conversations with a student and I'm like, you know, that might not be a good idea because of this, this, and this.
Yeah.
And then they go talk to somebody else. And then that person says, yeah, that might not be a good idea because of, and maybe the reasons are, you know, maybe we intersect at one of those reasons.
Yeah.
And then they go talk to a third one. And then we intersect again in the same reason.
Yes, yes, yes.
And sometimes that student needs to hear it 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then
yes.
they'll come back to you and be like, actually, I did talk to all my mentors and you all agreed that this would be a bad idea because of this.
Yes.
So it probably is true that it is a bad idea
because of this.
And so we just need to hear the things multiple times to actually make good decisions and have a lot of perspectives on any one decision we're going to make. And so you're absolutely right. The mentorship is key. And we have to have this system and network of mentors in place for any one student.
Yes. No, and I think you're absolutely right. And I'm struggling on the mentor side. Because, and part of it, you're helping me when you're saying this right now. Part of it is because, and we've said this, and we have to be very clear about this. Not only should a person have, you know, a mentor cabinet of people, but at the highest level, again, those people are interacting with each other.
Yes.
Because I have a mentee who I've been trying to mentor, and they just have not been listening to me. Mm. And that's fine. But now, given what you just said, I'm wondering, who the fuck are these other mentors she's talking to?
Exactly.
I'm like, yeah, because now, I mean, I had a really hard time in our last session where she, you know, is really struggling. And when I met her about content and the institution she was talking about, that I had the data was clear to me that she was going to struggle. Here we are. Uh-huh. N months later, and N is over 24. Here we are.
Oh.
And yeah, and she's on the verge of being kicked out.
Mm.
Okay, and this is an undergrad. And so so she related to me, you know, her troubles and that she was going through trouble. And then she said to me, I wish someone had told me that this was going to be this hard.
Oof.
And so I took that. I got in my feelings about that.
Yes.
Right? Because mm-hmm. I had put in over 24 months of effort to try mm-hmm. to be the one to tell her that this was going to be very difficult. And she was telling me that she wished someone had told her that it was going to be this difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I didn't resonate with her. I failed her. Right?
Mm.
And like, that's how I don't know any other way. So let me be clear. Like, I had a choice at that moment. You know, and at that moment, I want to be, it's uncensored. At that moment, I want to be like, motherfucker, what are you talking about? For 24 months, I've been telling you, right?
Yes.
But I've had a chance to reflect, and whatever I was doing just did not resonate in the way she needed to hear it. You know what
that's
I mean? And
this is exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's so hard for me to come to that realization.
But Eris, I literally said, we just had this conversation, you know, in the last episode when we ended.
Yeah.
And we were talking about if I need someone to give me advice that's going to uplift me and fill my cup, I go to you.
Yes, right.
Okay? I go to you if I need loving criticism.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay? That's who I go to. I go to Eris Winger for the loving criticism.
Yes.
I want somebody to set me straight.
Yes.
I go to Michael Young.
Right. Of course.
Okay. So what's happening is it's also like, I think there's times where, you know, students know what they're going to get from us.
Yes.
And so they go to the person for the thing that they need.
Yes.
Right. You have a child. You know
what
she can get from you and what she can get from your wife.
This is revelatory for me.
Okay.
No,
and
I'm so happy
you can't tell me our mentees aren't playing us sometimes.
No, and that's true. And she's not playing me, but you're right. Like,
no, but it's just the default.
Yes. Yes. No, but you're telling me something else. And I think you're still saying this. I just want to make sure that She could have never heard that from me because she gets something else from me.
Exactly.
Right.
You couldn't
I
be
never
the mentor
realized that.
Who could tell her you're about to fail.
But I literally, I told her that.
You could have said that. You could have literally said those words.
Yes.
But when I think of you, I wouldn't hear them.
Yeah. No, I think that's what happened. I think that's exactly what happened. And yes. And so I want to go through what this process of now I've reached peace. When I was told this by her, I was angry because I, in my mind, had spent so much time worried about her and loving her and showing so much concern and trying to do what was best for her. And then I heard something in which I felt all of that was erased because I tried to tell her and she said she didn't hear it. And I was like, I cannot believe I've been trying for this long and you didn't hear anything that I was saying. But now what you're helping me with right now is that that I had a different purpose for her.
Yes.
That was not centered around me telling her that. And that she is possible that she was never going to hear that from me.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is why we need mentoring networks.
Yes.
And I understand the hurt, you know, I hear and I feel the hurt, Eris. And I've been there too, right? Like, I have a mentee who I think the world of, and anytime an opportunity comes, immediately it's in her inbox. And, you know, and I have said to her, you know, you tell me that you want the opportunity to be a researcher, that you want to go the distance.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sending you teaching opportunities during the summer.
Right.
I'm not sending you, you know, good pedagogy books.
Yeah.
Like, I am sending you the things that I know are going to set you apart so that when you graduate, you can have a fantastic postdoc that doesn't require you to teach, so that you can get the kind of research job you want.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that for the better part of 4 years.
Mm.
And then, you know, the student sometimes goes off and takes all this side tutoring jobs, all this TAing, all this other thing. And when I look at them and I'm like, what do you want with your life? And they say, I want to be a researcher at a R1, you know, like really good school. And I'm like, all of those things are not helping.
Right.
You, I was like, what do you need? Well, okay, I need money. I'm like, let's try to find you a research, you know?
Yes.
And there's times where, like, I feel like I go out of my way, you know, to like help this student have the kind of opportunity that will help them succeed at the thing they say to me that they
need. Right.
And then this happened, you know, they reached out to me and they said, oh, I talked to person much younger than me with way less experience than me. Okay.
I wish people could see your face.
you know? And then I also talked to this other much younger person who's never gone through tenure track.
Yes. Yeah,
you know? And they said that, that I need to be doing more research. And so I decided that I might do the things that you suggested.
Oh my God.
And I'm just like, okay. So I don't know what I'm talking about. And then I understood. Then I understood. So it took me a while. It took me a while, but then I understood. And I had, I think, the same sort of set of feelings, right?
Yes.
Like, what the fuck? Am I chopped liver?
Right.
Like, so it takes other people to tell you because you think I'm lying?
Right.
Like, I got up in my feelings.
Yes.
And then I realized that it is hard for anyone to believe that I would know what it takes to be at a Research One institution when I was not at a Research One institution.
Yeah.
You get me?
Yeah.
So when my path took me through a teaching postdoc to a, you know, very good liberal arts tenure track, you know, but I went a different route.
Yeah.
And I crawled my way out of teaching institutions into a research position.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for that student to see me as being somebody at a research one.
Yeah.
Whereas they're looking at these younger students who are on that trajectory,
right,
who do have a research postdoc,
yes,
who did do a lot of research as graduate students, who are positioning themselves to land at these research one positions after their postdoc.
Mm.
And so it took her seeing them in that trajectory to believe that the thing I was saying,
yes,
about being in that trajectory was true.
Right, right.
And so
you
it's
had
just,
to accept that.
And I had to accept that,
yes,
that it wasn't personal. It wasn't
right.
that they don't trust me. It wasn't that they don't believe me. It's just that they need more mentors.
Yes, yeah. No,
this
powerful.
Isn't personal.
No, that's powerful, powerful, powerful. No, I feel a lot better. Yeah, no, yes, 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 yes.
Oof,
yes.
But it's hard. And,
yes,
and I think we need to... We need to talk more, you know, in depth about our mentoring failures.
Oh, yes.
And that could be a whole episode.
Oh, yes. We can have,
you know, there's
that's
a
right.
lot
Absolutely.
To unpack there.
Absolutely.
Both being a mentor and being a mentee.
Absolutely.
Right? Because we're,
Absolutely.
We still have our own mentors, you know, or tour mentors.
Yeah, maybe we can
I
do
like
it as a precursor
them.
To the event. So, yeah, that event,
yeah,
again, Mentoring for Equity, CIME, you can find it at MSRI.org. And we can put it in the show notes as well. Yeah, so the funding... Travel funding has been closed, but you can still join us there in March. So look that up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so in terms of the 5%, it makes me think about Luis Leyva's talk that I went to at the JMM. And so he gave this great talk about giving some perspectives of marginalized people in the discipline and what they go through at the K-12 space and how we can use some of these techniques for a post-secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And in the talk... He, you know, at the beginning, he said, I need to position myself before so that you understand who you're hearing this from and what I may not realize. And so he went through 6 bullet points about where he was from, who he was, how he identifies, what that might mean about what he's about to say, what he might be missing. And I was like, oh, my God, what would it look like for me to bring that to my classroom? Like to say at the beginning, on the first day, to say all the stuff I usually say, but to say, let me position myself about, you know, and for me, particularly with the struggles that I still have with being a man in this society and patriarchy and all of this, really thinking about how can I vocalize the fact that, again, these spaces were not built for women, were not built for people of color, and to acknowledge that in a way. I did not do that in my class. Yeah. So this was a week before my class started, and I could not get the words to work together to figure out how I wanted to say that in the way that I wanted to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I am thinking about that as my 5%, and like, how in the world can I do this the right way in front of a class? And I'm going to be afraid, but it's important to say, because I want to say that I want to acknowledge that, you know, particularly women have not, you know, been given the benefit of the doubt in math spaces. And I'm here to try and change that. Right. And it not come off as exclusionary or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. So his positioning, it changed my life because I was like, oh, my God, like I had never seen anybody do that. Right.
Yeah.
Just be like, let me tell you who I am and how this impacts what you're about to hear and what I might have missed and the challenges there. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, the 5% is really to just start thinking about, like, really being cognizant to what I say yes to. You know, my default continues to be yes.
Is it?
And
okay.
Yeah, because, you know, fear of missing out, fear
yes.
of being forgotten and irrelevant,
yes.
right?
Yes.
There's a lot of trauma there.
So let me ask you, I got to ask you this about...
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm wondering, your play has never been really full enough that you can just be, that it's changed the default?
No, because I just won't sleep, right? Like, I will cut out everything else until, you know.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Until my mental health is in the peak,
yes,
you know?
Yes,
so
yes,
it's
yes,
just like,
yes.
yeah. And so I can't continue to live that way.
Yes.
So that's a danger.
Yes.
But I think just more than anything... You know, when a young person asks me for my time, my default is yes.
Oh, for sure for me.
You know,
yes,
for
yes,
sure.
Yes, yes,
like,
yeah.
they need something. I'm like, yep, let's go talk. Let's
right.
do this. You know, the mentoring part of it, I think, is makes sense to me because it's who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about, like, some of this stuff that just doesn't feel like it's leading to change, being on some committees yes. where, you know, I just continue to say the same things and I've said them for a year yes. and nothing's happening. Peace yes. out. On to the next thing.
Yes.
And again, I can hear the naysayers like, well, the only way to make change is to keep doing it. And I'm like, nope, same input, same output. Like, it's yes. not happening. Correct. It maybe Pamela cannot make change there.
Right.
Maybe it takes Eris. Right. Like, right. it just, correct. There's times, again, we can say the exact same things. And they might listen to you and they might not listen to me.
Correct.
Right. So we just had this discussion. And so I think sometimes, like, it might make sense for me to step down from certain things and yes. just hand the baton to a new person.
Good for you.
Because they might, you know, it might benefit them. It gives them visibility. Right. So I think I'm thinking very cognizantly when an invitation comes my way to just forward it to somebody who it could benefit and somebody who can learn something from it. Get better connected, and then leaves my plate a little emptier in case
good for
something
you.
that really only I can do, I yes. will do.
Yes. Or so do you want to go to the beach?
What is that? I will spend more time with my doggies.
Yes, absolutely.
And my
absolutely.
And my kid and husband. So
that's right.
So yeah, so I think that's my 5% to just not... By 5%, if by 5% I can default to a no, I have made huge progress in my
Let's
life.
Let's go. Excellent. Announcements.
All right. Some announcements. Yeah. So the Edge Summer Program, the application is coming due February 15th.
Oh my God. That's so in 2 weeks. Yeah.
I know. Encourage your students to apply. So edgeforwomen.org. We also have an announcement for a study. So Tim McIndowie is working on Knowledge Gap. So this is the undergraduate knowledge of the mathematics graduate school application process. So there's a survey that will ask math majors, preferably in their third or fourth year, about what they know in their interest in applying to graduate school and basically how they found out about graduate school to begin with. So there's going to be a link that we're going to post in case you want to share that with your students. We really encourage you to do that. We want to figure out how to fill some of these gaps in the understanding on how to go through that process for students. So really, really impactful work. Please contribute to it by sharing the survey with your students.
We'll post the link in the show notes.
For sure.
Thank you for the time, as always.
You already know. I appreciate you.
Who are you?
I am Pamela Harris.
And I am Eris Winger. And you're listening to Mathematically Uncensored, where our talk is real and complex.
But never discreet.
Later, people.
Bye.